بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين Welcome to the 38th session of the Thought Forum, a weekly open discussion covering pertinent Islamic issues. This forum promotes a platform for open discussion with respect and tolerance of other people's points of view. Today's topic is entitled Defending Our Beliefs. Are believers too relaxed in responding to takfiri attacks on them? With us is Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who will be discussing this pertinent topic. He's going to be presenting a short lecture on the topic at hand, and thereafter we'll be having an open discussion to discuss what needs to be said on this topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Bari al-Khalaika ajma'in, wa salatu wa salam ala Rasulihi al-Kareem, wa ala ahlihi al-Tayyibin al-Tahirin, wa salawat. Assalamu alaikum jamia. And before I start, I'd like to give a big shout out to our sister Hina, because it's her birthday today. So everybody give a big salawat for sister Hina. The person who is looking kind of embarrassed, that's sister Hina. Now, the issue of takfirism, if one can call it that, I think is a very burning issue with respect to Shias. For one thing, I have been to a number of universities and have met or given speeches to a number of Shia organizations, among them many youth. And after every speech, there's always somebody who comes up to me and expresses that they have been at a loss as to how to defend themselves against aggressive takfirism or aggressive Salafism. I also get phone calls while I am here also by people who are card-carrying Shias, not to mention maybe new converts who also have this problem. And because of this, it has become clear to me that takfirism in the extreme sense and sectarianism in a more wider sense is something that is a very demoralizing thing among us, and it points out to the fact that we do not have any type of measures or programs to counteract that. Could you turn off the echo, please? I'm not a mad dog. There are many verses in the Holy Quran where Allah talks against sectarianism. And I want to mention some of these, make a small comment on them, and then reflect back on the current situation that we have in our midst. And the first one is where Allah says, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ فَرَّقُوا دِينَهُمْ وَكَانُوا شِيَعًا لَسْتَ مِنْهُمْ فِي شَيْءٍ. Indeed, Allah says, those who split up their religion and become partisan or become sects, you should have nothing to do with them. Okay, so do not associate yourself with people who want to split up their religion. Also, Allah says, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, لا تكونوا من المشركين من الذين فرقوا دينهم وكانوا شيعا كل حزب بما لديهم فرحون. And do not be among the polytheists of those who split up their religion and become partisan, each faction exulting in what it possessed. And he also says, وَلَا تَقُولُوا لِمَنْ أَلْقَى إِلَيْكُمْ السَّلَامُ لست مؤمنا تبتغون عرض الحياة الدنيا. And do not say to someone who offers you salams, you are not a believer, seeking the transitory wares of the life of this world. Now, when we look at these three verses, what Allah is condemning here is not differences in opinion. It is the act itself of using opinion to split up the ummah or to split up the community on the basis of these opinions. And we see the reasons, some of the reasons why this is done, the psychological dimension or the psychological background of this type of action. And the psychological background of it is where, for example, one group is exulting in what it possesses. Bima ladayhim farihun, that they are happy, that they are exulting in what they possess. That they say, oh, we are better than such and such. You know, I'm so glad I am a this and I'm so glad I'm a that. I think this reflects sometimes the attitude of Muslims themselves with respect to even other religions, you know, that you have what we call Islam worship, not the worship of God, but the worship of Islam, you know, and so by, it's like almost, you know, identifying with a particular group, just by identification makes you a better person, you know, and this is extremely incorrect. You know, what makes you a better person is your taqwa. What makes you a better person is your practice of your deen. What makes you a better person is your patience with other people. What makes you a better person is your humility. And here you have a situation where people are exulting in what they do, in their opinion. Or, as the other verse says, seeking the transitory wares of the life of this world. You know, for example, wanting to create or bring into existence more followers, wanting to influence the state and get power, because power is the aim in and of itself. So Islam does not, and the Holy Quran is not talking about differences in opinion. Differences in opinion must necessarily arise. And this is a phenomenon one sees with respect to religion itself. You know, most religions, all religions begin as a unity, all true religions that is, begin as a unity, and as time goes on and it becomes further and further away from the time of the founder of that religion or the bringer of that religion, you would find that differences of opinion takes place. Differences of opinion with respect to the doctrine. They might accept the doctrine, but they might understand the doctrine in different ways. This is something quite normal to happen among religions. You know, so for example, you might meet a Wahhabi who might say God has a hand because, you know, the Quran says, Yadallah foka aidihim. You know, you might find that they might say, not a hand like mine, but, you know, a divine hand, you know, whatever that means. We might dispute that, but we do not dispute the fact that they believe in God, you know. We could say that, for example, you know, Allah gives life to the dead, you know, and therefore we might have a problem with Jesus giving life to the dead, for example. You know, but you don't dispute the existence of Jesus and the fact that he is a prophet. You know, so we would have differences of opinion, and we see this in the history of Islam, where we have clashed over not only doctrine, for example, doctrine over the justice of God, you know, the Mu'tazila, Ash'ari type of thing. We also have disputes or differences in terms of the understanding and the application of Islamic law. And when you look at the development of these differences of opinion, you do find periods in history where the people who adhere to one particular view tended to have a sectarian attitude to other people who had a different view. And so you would find that this phenomenon of takfirism is not something new in Islam. However, over time, positions change or moderate, and people become more and more amenable to each other and more able to tolerate differences. So once in the past, the different followers of the four schools of thought in Sunnism in different parts of the Islamic world, you know, fought each other and so forth, you find today they have a mutual accord. The Shia, the Ithna Ashari Shia in particular, was outside of this development, even though there were movement and there was interrelationships between the Shia and the Sunni, until Sheikh Shaltut, in his communication with Ayatollah Burujerdi, came out with this famous fatwa that the Ja'fari school of thought is a fifth madhab in Shiaism. What we have noticed recently, and recently I mean by the 1979 with the victory of the Islamic Revolution, you found an increase in sectarian type of attitudes or sectarian, fanning the flames of sectarianism taking place in especially the Sunni Muslim world. And this was directly in opposition to the call of Imam Khomeini in particular for other Muslims to rise up and overthrow their imperialist stooge leaders and establish an independence from foreign control in their environments. Secondly, you had the example itself of the Islamic Republic as an option or as a model for these countries. The most important question that was being asked by the rulers of these lackey states in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and so on was, how do we counter the attraction of the Islamic Republic upon Sunnis? How could we encounter this? Because this Islamic revolution was one that was appealing. It came at a time at the end of the great anti-colonial, anti-imperialist movements in the world. And if you remember these anti-colonialist and anti-imperialist movements, all these revolutions were attractive to people. So you'd find Muslims, for example, being very attractive to communist Che Guevara, for example, you know, or Ho Chi Minh, and so on. Why? Because these people stood their ground and defeated imperialist attacks upon them. And so the Islamic Revolution followed in that particular footstep and became attractive not only to Sunnis, but also attractive to non-Muslims like me. And because of this, many, many, many people were starting to convert to Islam. So when you see, when you hear about Egyptian Shias and you know, Tunisian Shias and so on, Shias who are in largely, you know, majority-dominated Sunni countries, many of them, their Shiaism goes back to the Islamic Revolution. So they wanted to know, these lackeys and the their backers in the Western world wanted to know how to counteract this. And one of the things we know, we realize, is when you want to counter religion, you cannot counter religion with irreligion. You can't counter religion with atheism, for example. Okay, you suppress religion with atheism, as they did in the Soviet Union, but you cannot counter it. You cannot change religion with atheism. You can only counter religion with religion. You can only counter a true religion with a false religion. You can only counter a religion with a message of liberation, with a religion that has a message of hate for the religion that is promoting liberation. And this is where you find this ramping up of hatred against Shiaism. Before, it was fine. We coexisted. There were tensions, but we coexisted. And it was a good relationship. But right after the Islamic Revolution, you find this particular increased activity taking place. In the midst of this, you have the victory of the Lebanese resistance. I wouldn't mention his name because I don't know if it's legal to say, you know. But the Lebanese resistance against Zionist invasion. And again, once more, you found a lot of Sunni brothers and sisters saying, well, we're not doing anything. You know, those guys are doing something in the name of Islam. So there's got to be something good about them, something attractive about them, something right about them. So you had a whole, revivification of this movement towards embracing Shia Islam, or at least embracing the model of the Islamic Revolution. And again, we found an even greater increase and ramping up of Takfirism. The point where it got to was that many of these Takfiris were saying public enemy number one is not Israel, is not American imperialism. Public enemy number one is Shiaism. It's very interesting that you find these the involvement of Salafism, extremist Salafism and Takfirism taking place, riding on the shoulders of the Arab Spring, especially in non-monarchical countries. Okay, you don't find them very active in the non-monarchical countries. You don't find them, for example, rising up or trying to bring down the government in Saudi Arabia or in Qatar or in the Emirates. No. Okay, you find them in Syria, you find them in Libya, you know, you find them in Mubarak's Egypt, and so on. You see? So it also indicates, and when we look at their support, it also indicates that this type of movement has a political agenda. Now, what does it mean for us here in the West? In the West, with the backing of these countries and the enthusiasm of the youth, who are the major targets of this type of movement, you find that they are becoming more and more the ones to define what Islam is. And so Islam, they have contributed, their brothers overseas, where they do the terrorist acts, they have actually contributed to the destruction of the visage of Islam in the West. It's a very interesting hadith by Imam Ali alayhi salam, who says, he said, I heard the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi saying, that there will come a people during the last days who will be young and rash-minded. The sufaha, they'll be young and rash-minded. Their words will be the best of words, or will be the best words of the righteous. Their prayers will be more than your prayers. Their recitation of Quran will be more than your recitation. However, their faith will not go past their collarbones. And in some hadith of the same type, they say not past their throats. They will leave the true faith as swiftly as an arrow is fired from a bow. Meaning, the true faith, the true iman, is enlightenment of the heart. This is the true iman. The true iman is purification of your behavior. This is true iman. There's another aspect of iman, which is just talk, which is just the beautiful speech. You know, that people sometimes think they believe something because the speech is something that attracts them. You see? And so they are convinced about this, but it is up to here. They go out there and they regurgitate what they have heard, but it does not resonate in their heart. It is a superficial attachment. And people with a superficial attachment to deen, it leads them to abandoning the deen. Now, abandoning the deen does not necessarily mean not stop being a Muslim. Abandoning the religion means abandoning the adab of the religion, means abandoning the meaning of the religion. And so you find, for example, these takfiris have no problem killing innocent people. You know. I'm sure you probably have heard of the video where they murdered Syrian soldiers in cold blood. You know, these types of cruelty, these types of inhuman behavior do not represent or reflect the fact that they have an iman. Their iman is not based upon love, but based upon hatred. Their iman is not based upon humility, but is based upon supremacism. What are we Muslims or we Shia to do? If we claim that our religion, our madhab, is the true madhab, if we claim that our madhab is one that is the pure Muhammadi madhab, then we should be able or should take the responsibility of proclaiming that without being sectarian, without dissing our Sunni brothers and sisters. We could engage in dialogue with them with respect. We could agree to disagree for strategic purposes, because we know that as long as we are identified as Muslim, whether you are Shia or you are Sunni, it will come back upon the other person depending upon what we do. It means also that we ourselves have to be able to contain elements and activity of Shia takfirism itself, of Shia supremacism itself. Because we do have such elements among our own ranks. It means that we have to devise programs to educate our youth and our adults with respect to the different attacks that they carry out upon us, so that when we are confronted with it, we are able to defend ourselves. How much more time do I have?
1 minute.
Okay. Okay, so I'll stop there. I just want to end up by reading something from Imam Khomeini and Imam Khamenei about this business of Shia opposition to takfirism and the role of sectarianism in dividing people. Imam Khomeini is reported, it says, "Today world peace is such that all countries are under the political influence of the superpowers. They observe a control everywhere and have schemes for defeating every group. The most important of these is sowing discord among brothers. Muslims should be awake. Muslims should be alert that if a dispute takes place among Sunni and Shia brothers, it is harmful to all of us. It is harmful to all Muslims. Those who want to sow discord are neither Sunni nor Shia. They are agents of the superpowers and work for them." Now, you could be an agent of the superpower overtly, covertly. You make your own decision to do so, or you could be functioning on your own in their interest. You don't have to be working for them to function. You don't have to be working directly for them in order to work for them. You know what I mean. Those who attempt to cause discord among our Sunni and Shia brothers are people who conspire with the enemies of Islam and want the enemies of Islam to triumph over Muslims. They are the supporters of America, and some are supporters of the Soviet Union. And we do see that, for example, in the conflict in Iraq, when the invasion took place, you know, you had these foreign paramilitary groups dressing up like Arabs and riding around all over the place, creating fitna, you know, creating crimes so that Sunnis get to hate Shias and Shias get to hate Sunni. You had that type of a thing. I hope that through considering this Islamic precept that all Muslims are brothers, all Islamic countries will triumph against the superpowers and succeed in actualizing all Islamic ordinances. And then another word from Ayatollah Khamenei, who says, then they try to say the Islamic Republic is a Shia Republic and try to portray it against the great Sunni society and try to stir up sectarian tensions and bigotry. This is the use of religion to create division. They don't see the acts of brotherhood of the Islamic Republic of Iran towards, let's say, for example, the people in Palestine and Gaza who are Sunni. They don't see the acts of brotherhood for the Islamic Republic of Iran, which supported the struggling Sunni brothers in Bosnia. They don't see these types of things. They don't see their support for these people. You know, what they are blind. All they can see is a sect. And this is what makes them an easy tool for the superpowers. This is an important and dangerous point. And in fact, it is of the doing of their corrupt political hands. All of us must do our utmost and put all our energy in destroying this plot of the oppressive powers. Everyone must be alert, including all our nation officials, religious students, our hard-working religious scholars who serve the people. All must pay attention not to do or say anything that will help the plan of the enemies of Islam. This obligation is also on the Sunni school of thought. Our Sunni brothers should also know the enemy's plot is to stir up conflict and sectarianism between us, to make brothers kill each other. Nothing less than this. They too, the Sunnis, must be awake and alert to the threat. So here we see Imam Khamenei actually saying that we have a responsibility. All of us have a responsibility to counteract this. And we have a responsibility on two levels. One level is to proclaim and spread the glorious teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and to spread our school of thought in this part of the world, especially where people are thirsty for spirituality. The other one is to promote the truth of our beliefs so that we could counter these basically ignorant attacks, because they resort to lies. They resort to innuendo. I was on a bus yesterday and I saw a very ardent and enthusiastic convert to their belief, wearing the short dash and everything, you know, talking to a friend and was saying that, you know, Shias are, this guy, he's trying to convert this guy and saying that Shias are not kafir, a kafir. And one of the reasons why they are kafir is because we say Ya Ali. You know? And we believe that people in the grave, are conscious. You know, and we love Hussein, when you should only love the Prophet and things of that nature. You know, and so there's very, very a lot of stupidity happening out there, but there's nothing from our community to counteract it. We need to write about these things. We need to make videos about these things and put it on the internet. And we need to have sessions that teach us how to counteract these types of accusations. Thank you very much. Sorry for talking too long.
Sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, thank you for that excellent presentation. We're now going to move across to the opportunity for our audience to interact with us and discuss the topic at hand. So, can we have a raise of hands for those who would like to make the first contributions?
Is that when you do interact with a different a person from a different background or from a different sect of Islam, the arguments I usually get are the same arguments over and over again. But when you do answer the arguments to the best of your ability and convince them in a sense, listen, for example, saying your Ali means this and the Tawbah or Imam Hussein, when you get to that concept and you explain to them the importance in the whole for this, the importance they had for the whole of Islam to stay alive, they don't understand it, they stay ignorant. So what do we do at this point? Do we continue or do we just ignore them? Because there's a level that they keep crossing, which is sometimes they even say, oh, you're too full of Ahlul Bayt when you let a person, like for example, a person in Syria kill his people. And when you try to explain to them who's actually doing the killing, and who's actually suspecting the Holy Family by attacking their graves, they just close their ears and their eyes and they say, you're lying, you're the one who does all the killing. So what do we do? Do we contract or do we just ignore? Or what level do we just retaliate? Should we just ignore everything and just act like nothing is happening, or just retaliate for each person? I would like to ask this.
Okay. Our attitude is only to enlighten people or bring the truth. And to do that, you need to engage them on the level of their reason. As long as a person is using their reason, okay, as long as you make a point, a valid point, you know, and they concede that valid point, you could be in a situation, and you too, if they make a valid point against you and you can't defend it, you have to concede it, all right? I mean, conceding to somebody doesn't necessarily mean that you have to change your religion then and there, all right? You know, because to change your religion, it requires some time. It requires, for example, that question that you couldn't answer, that you have to go to people to find out the answer. Okay, or you have to think about it. This is how people grow in debating capabilities. Now, if that person refuses to use their reason and resorts to, for example, insults or resorts to just mindless accusations without hearing you, then there's no basis for speaking with them again. You know, that's a time where you cut the discussion. Because now you'll just be talking to a human, a person who appears human. You know, you're not using their mind. Okay, so that's where you cut the discussion. The other thing is that another way of convincing people is through power. I don't mean physical power, right? I mean power of your ideas dominating an environment. What, for example, we need to do? Let's say. Larger universities is where you tend to have, discussions and seminars and so forth, right? Is to be in control of your agenda. You don't let these other guys dominate the Islamic agenda, okay? Another thing is the use of this word Shia, okay? You know, I hear a lot of Shias yesterday, you know, remember when I was here, one guy was talking about this, the English boy. Remember that? The English boy? You see, he saw a Muslim sister sitting on the lap of an English boy. Remember that? Yeah. You know, assuming that the English boy is a non-Muslim. You know, of course, it meant a white English boy, right? You know, it meant. I think the same type of dynamic with the word Shia. I'm not anti-Shia. I'm not anti the word Shia. Okay? But I've met people who say to me, when you became... How long was it between the time you became Muslim and the time you became Shia? See the problem? Okay? You know, there was a lot of Muslims in the room, but very few Shias. Okay? You see the problem? You are actually giving away your right to be called a Muslim. And you find a lot of Takfiri attacks call us Shia and don't call us Muslim. So I think it is better for us to take that higher ground and define our organizations as Islamic organizations. This place is called the Islamic Center of England. It's not called the Shia Islamic Center of England, you know, the Shia Center of England or whatever, right? It is the Iranian Shia Center of England, you know, but on the outside, you don't know that, you see? And because of this, you'd find Sunnis coming in here, ordinary people coming in here for knowledge on Islam. But if you had the Shia Center of England, an ordinary person would pass by there and Shia, what's that? I don't know what's that, and keep going, you see? So these are strategies that we need to employ in order to take back the higher ground.
You said that the Takfiri comments came as a result of the Islamic Republic Revolution, the revolution in Iran, right?
Sorry.
Okay, as an indirect consequence.
Attacks, Takfiri attacks.
Yes. 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 But why, what do you think was attracting those people that you said who were present in Tunisia, Egypt, amongst a largely Sunni population to Shiism through the Islamic Revolution?
Right.
What was the link between the two?
The success, you know. Here you have Muslim communities, all of them suffering under some kind of Shah, okay, some kind of king, you know, who is nothing but the lackey of a Western power. All of them see that their ulama, you know, their people are not doing anything in the name of Islam. In fact, everybody who is actually fighting against this is a socialist or a communist. There's no Islamic ideology. And then out of the blue, you have an Islamic revolution. An Islamic revolution. This is attractive. You see? And so they become curious. You know, what is special about these guys? And then you hear, I heard about this Islamic revolution. You know? And I mean, it's right up my alley because I was involved in and interested in revolution from that small, you know. And so I became curious and I started reading and I started studying. And this is the same thing that happened with these brothers, you know. They started reading and studying and finding out about Shiism and then coming to the conclusion, well, yeah, there is an Ahlul Bayt. And, you know, they were oppressed and so forth and so on, you know. And they made the change. You know, so I think success is very important.
The link between Shiism and rising against oppression.
Yes.
So do you think that's a very obvious link for everyone?
We should be able to stand up against oppression, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in school, even whether it's in our own community. That's a problem. We don't stand up for oppression in our own against oppression in our own community. Wherever we are, you know, and we show a good example, and people become attracted to this, you know. Take, for example, let's say in our community in the I use universities a lot of times because this is a place where you find more than everywhere people, you know, having these programs and so on. But you can do so in your neighborhood, I don't know, community center and so forth, right? Say, for example, you were at the forefront of that, you know, that your organization, your Ahlul Bayt organization, or on a wider level, an organization that is a group of Muslims, Shia and Sunni, who are interested in justice and who accept each other. Hmm? That dominating the environment, okay, would just sort of let people fall right in line. You know, your success is something that would be very attractive to other people. And it would be very dissuading for those people who would be against you.
The first question reads, would responding to anti-Shia sectarian, I've got rhetoric here, itself fuel sectarianism or neutralize it? The idea being is, does responding to these attacks against Shia Islam present a solution, or does it actually make the matter worse?
Of course, respond is important, but the way of respond is more important, actually. How you respond that, as Sheikh Hanif said, that you shouldn't respond in the manner of to win the discussion. That's very important. And as well, that you should try to keep inside your anger, actually. You should only use the intellectual level when you respond. And I see, mashallah, I see that despite when I just study the history of the Wahhabism, today they have changed many of their ideas, actually. And I think that's because of their contact with Shias and because of the Shias' critique to their way of belief. So I think they are changing a lot of their way, alhamdulillah. But still, the manner they use is to say the truth and do something else. But at least now we have got that level, that they say the truth, which is very important. We can build on that. and respond, of course, is in right manner is good and healthy, absolutely.
Yeah, I think dialogue is very important. I don't think we do enough of it. I think a lot of the conversations that go on are at the kind of one-to-one level, and you know, it doesn't always achieve much because individuals don't tend to have enough, perhaps, knowledge about the areas to be able to defend their particular views. And quite often it will kind of, you know, people fight fire with fire and, you know, end up actually cursing the others and, you know, doing the same things that we despise that they do to us. And that's completely the wrong way to do it. I think there probably needs to be more of an effort, perhaps at the scholarly level. And, you know, should we have some centres open which actually allow scholars to share their thoughts and, you know, discuss things in a public arena. So invite both Shias and Sunnis at a neutral venue, not a venue. Many Sunnis may feel that this venue here is actually a Shia venue, so I don't want to go there. So should there not be a centre where we find like-minded Muslims from any madhab who are willing to actually make an effort to come together and realise that we're stronger together rather than fighting each other?
One level of engagement is on the mass level. You know, where, for example, you have a Shia Sunni dialogue in a big hall or amphitheater, and you have, you know, knowledgeable people on top of the stage and so on. It's on the mass level, you know. You have engagement on an intellectual level, you know, by experts between the two talking and stuff like that. And then you have the engagement on an individual, personal level. You know, for example, the ordinary Wahhabi that you meet outside, okay, he's not a sheikh, he's not a scholar, you know. He's somebody they gave ideas to. You know, when he encounters you, he starts to regurgitate these ideas. You see? You knowing what, and he will be giving that idea to many other people. He's out there trying to bring people into his way of thinking. You see? And so therefore engaging that individual. Because, I mean, there are people who would keep quiet. Huh? So they're no big deal. And there are people who will say something, right? And you engage the ones who say something. You see? Engaging that person at that level does have a ripple effect. You know, because after you finish with them, if they're smart, you know, or have a moderate level of intelligence, you know, they would be disturbed by what you say. They would be confused by what you say, for example. They would be in conflict by what you say. You know, and this would lead them to ask questions, to do research, you know, and therefore they might be able to come to our opinion.
Yeah. I think theory of that, yeah, is a good one. I mean, I like to engage with people on a personal level as well. I just find that, you know, if people do actually go to look for validation and of the arguments that you make, unfortunately, if you type Shia on the internet, you know, what comes back?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's all lies, a lot of it. So, I'd say 99% of it is lies, what you'll find. So, you know, should there be more of an effort of us actually getting more content on the internet? You know, there are many technological ways of actually, you know, I don't know, the search engine optimization where a lot of companies use to get their name to come up to the top. But should we not actually have a fund for these
Absolutely.
Things and actually try and push it forward?
We're getting to the point here.
The way I see it, there are two issues. One is Shi'ism and the way how we convey what Shi'ism represent to other people, and in particular the Sunni brothers and the Wahhabis, Salafis. This can be done as long as it is in a safe environment. That's no problem. We can discuss, like you mentioned, the idea is not to win arguments or debates. Neither should we intend to convert the opposite person to Shia Islam. Because after all, whether we like it or not, we are on the defense somehow because of the events that we've been taking place. We have to justify ourselves. We have to defend ourselves from knowledge point of view, not physically. But that I will come to later.
You mean the physical you'll come to later?
Yes. Right. And you can tell actually from the way the people ask questions and the type of questions and the number of questions, how ignorant they are about Shia. Some of them completely none. But it is in a way a blessing, if you think about it. The way the Wahhabis and Salafis, with their campaign against Shia, it is a blessing in a way people start wondering, who are those guys? What is Shia? And by that, that's a good starting point. Now, when they meet someone with enough knowledge, those who are truly after the truth, they will be willing to listen. And the spread of Shiaism in the world now, it is becoming evident, so that all the authorities or those in charge, the Salafis, are getting worried about it. The president of Iran, when he went to Egypt, Ahmadinejad, the leaders of the Azhar, the first thing they said to him, look, this is a really laughable sometimes, so absurd. They told him, oh, we don't want you to export Shiaism to Egypt. As if Shiaism is a product wrapped up in boxes, and Muhammad Ahmadinejad came with a plane full of these boxes hand over to the Egyptian. Now, this tells you honestly how simple those guys are. This is the Azhar people. Those are the sheikhs. Now, they do not know this is a self-exploration. People commit themselves. It's about aqeedah. It's about belief. They go to the extent they reject all the things that have been brought up since he was young, and on the concept, misconception actually, realizing, oh my goodness, what a waste of life I had spent. Now this is the truth. And they're spreading everywhere, in Palestine, in Gaza, in Egypt, in Tunis, especially in Northern African countries. Now, this is, no one pushed them, but they look around them. South of Lebanon, Sheikh Hanif, don't mention names, I don't know why, but anyway, you know who I'm talking about. People looked at them, so who are this group? Why are they so successful? They actually confronted the monster of the Middle East, and they won them, and they just handful of them. For 65 years, they were humiliated, those countries, 23 countries, treated like dirt. And they couldn't do anything about it. And they start wondering, what's so special about those guys? Ah, they're Shia. Let's study about them. And because of them, by the way, without them asking them to commit to Shiaism, because the fact their acts, many people converted to Shiaism. Yeah. Now, this is one concept. That is no worry, because as long as we're on the right path, Allah will sustain us. Just like He sustained Iran during infancy up to now. Time and time again, and enemies of Iran, they failed. They plan, and Allah planned. Allah best planners. Now, there's something worrying though, is the actual physical attacks, the mass murder, the genocide that's taking place against Shia. This is my concern, and I wish, Sheikh Hanif, if you touch upon this matter, please, later, is that Allah says that in punishment, you survive. We're trying to preserve life here. There's some Shia in part of the world. They are, like says the paper, being extinct in Andalusia. The whole village, Shia, they've been just, their homes wiped out, burned, broken everything down, and put them in isolation somewhere. Just because they're Shia. In Pakistan, it's become a common practice. And those who commit these murders, they're wandering around in the street of Pakistan, untouched. So it is important, we're not talking about Muslims, by the way, we're not talking about unity here. This is a serious matter. It is killing people, innocent people, without punishment, without paying for it. Now, we have to stop this. And it is very disappointing and disheartening to see that Muslim countries, and in particular, say, Shia motivated in that respect, they're not doing much, unfortunately. We don't see any support. Now, the other question is, okay, now no one is supporting them. They have to defend themselves. That's the simplest right they can have. We're not encouraging tit for tat and sort of reaction attacks, random ones. Like they do, they just kill children, women, just because they're Shia. No, those, they have to defend themselves. They know who's doing the killing. They know who's giving the fatwa. By the way, if you just encourage murder, you're just part of it. In this country, if you speak publicly and allow or encourage or entice murder, they get arrested and put in jail just for simply saying it. Right? So we know who's doing this. They should actually somehow, some people that are in trouble, they have really to go after them. Hunt them down, at least. If the local government cannot do anything, which is obviously they can't, especially in Pakistan, right? Local people who are really, no one guarantees, if they leave their home, they cannot guarantee they can come back home again safely. Well, what kind of life is this? Just because they're Shia? Now they have to do something about it. So please, Brother Sheikh Hanif, what do you think? I mean, there's a question number four, I think.
I think my understanding, the impression I get, is that it's because of the dissimulation of Shia, that they're actually, you know, historically always hid their beliefs, and the fact that they are Shia because of, you know, the historical persecution, and that's continued into the modern communities. It's some way passed on in the culture, family backgrounds, and I've heard many poor Muslims tell me this. That Shias are afraid to be known as Shia.
So there's a lack of confidence?
Absolutely. Total, utter lack of confidence in the community.
Okay.
My contribution basically takes you, continues from that conversation, is that obviously, yes, we have been hiding ourselves, or maybe we've been keeping quiet about what belief or sect we belong to. The issue is that in schools, obviously, with the global issue, which is spreading quite dramatically from one person to the other, from families, and everybody seems to be concerned about what's happening in Syria or perhaps Rohingya or Pakistan or anywhere else. Obviously, lots of families are being affected. That's also playing on the children's minds. Now, in schools, there have been issues where now children are not being, they're being picked on at school from other children who are Muslims. And if they express their anger at a time where they're also feeling that they're losing lots of members of their families, perhaps in Pakistan or elsewhere around the world, then they are also allowing people to understand that they are Shia, and that makes it worse for them.
I think it is something that we need to seriously consider, because with the rise of takfirism, there's a rise of anti-Shia hate, and hate leads to violence against people. And so therefore our kids need to be trained to defend themselves. You need two things. You need Islamic self-defense. Islamic self-defense on an aqidah, intellectual level, so they can stand up to anybody who wants to challenge their belief. And they need also to defend themselves physically, to be able to be confident in themselves if they are intimidated by any of these people. And if they so much as raise their hand against them, they could know what to do with them. You know, I think these are two important things that our kids in the West need to learn and to know. Not to go around with a chip on your shoulder and challenge everybody, you know, but to be able to present a point of view, to be able to present what you believe in, and to be able to do some taekwondo on somebody if they just make the mistake of trying to, you know, chump you out. You know, and this type of stuff is happening a lot more often now on campuses and in high schools. And it is something that we have to prepare our children to do.
Bonding is the one of the issues which has done it difficult here for us to show the truth. But I mean, for the, you know, the cursing in front of, on the internet, and cursing on the air direct on, in front of the air camera, TV camera, that all those things have surely made it more difficult to discuss, because when you curse their people who they always have believed that they were close to the Prophet, of course you won't find, even between Sunnis, you won't find people who would like to listen to your argument, which even if you go around somehow, they will they will direct understand that you are speaking like those cursing people.
The question itself, so what are the issues that we have that make us incapable of responding to the threat? Well, I think one of the main ones is the idea of taqiyya, and which, for those who don't know, that's what it means, is that actually not hiding who you are, say, so lying almost, but only to protect if your life is directly in threat. But many Muslim brothers actually say that Shia are allowed to lie in any situation. So no matter what you say, you know, it's going to be a lie. You're just saying it to kind of distort what they're thinking, so they don't think anything bad of you, so they don't see you as a threat. So, you know, it's almost impossible to tell the truth as a Muslim who follows Ahlul Bayt, because, you know, they're not going to believe you no matter what you say. So, I mean, you know, how do we tackle that? I mean, my idea is that actually always referring to ourselves as a Shia Muslim, identifying ourselves as Shia first, is actually a mistake. We should always say that we're Muslim first. You know, what better name than the name that Allah has given us himself? And I think, you know, a lot of my Muslim friends, they're not Shia Muslim. And, but they probably don't know that I am. But it's largely... Sorry? not because I had to lie or anything. Maybe because it doesn't come up. It just doesn't come up. They just see my example and they see the Islam in me. And they just think that I'm like them. They just think I'm any other Muslim. And I think that's how we should be doing it. Actually, making everyone feel comfortable that we're just Muslims, just like them, and let them see the Islam in you, not through you telling them that I'm a Shia Muslim, but by saying I'm a Muslim, and then demonstrating your Islam.
Right? Dissimulation, it doesn't mean lying. Dissimulation means, you know, encouraging a different opinion about you that is not the accurate opinion of yourself. Right? I think you guys are all right. This taqiyya business, this dissimulation business, is something that has been a cultural element in many of our communities. But now we are in Europe. Now we are in the West. And the bazaar of ideas in the West is free and open. You can be anything, you can say anything, as long as you don't speak against the Queen. You know what I mean? All right, you could put your ideas on the bazaar, and this is where we have a problem, and we have this problem because we are, as I mentioned before, we are too inward looking, we are too restricted in ourselves, we are too ethnically oriented. You know, our centers are still Iranian centers and Iraqi centers and Lebanese centers and so forth. You know, and it is because of this that we have not been able to assert ourselves in this market of ideas.
In terms of that point too, I also wanted to make a point of we've, in general, becoming so completely desensitized to so many issues globally, and I think that's like a lot to do with how we consume media, you know, and how certain causes are shown to us over others. So like, for example, like, you know, it can be all over the report that a girl's been shot in Pakistan by someone from the Taliban, but, you know, every year there's like 186 children of the same age that die under US drone attacks. And I think there's like, you know, in terms of what makes us incapable, sometimes it's that we actually don't know, and sometimes we don't care because we've been completely desensitized to some of these issues. So in terms of like, I think it's again, like, it's a lot about how we get our knowledge, you know, and what kind of sources from kind of mainstream media sources we get this from.
I think the brother that you mentioned have the point I wanted to make.
Okay.
I think Shias are suffering from inferiority complex and fear. That's why they hide their belief. They don't want to express it. And when we see Sunnis, for example, they have audacity in showing their belief with no fear. For example, they believe that the parents of the Prophet are kafirs, and they show it. They say it with audacity, and they feel
confidence. Yeah.
And we certain things that happened in the past regarding Sahaba, whatever, we are afraid of mentioning facts that happened just because of they're going to think negatively about us. I think this is just self-esteem is very low in Shiism, inferiority complex, and fear as well from execution what happened in the past. So if the parents of the Prophet, they were kuffars, why would Sahabas are angels? What would make them angels? That's the point I want to make.
I forgot to say Salaam Alaikum last time, so Salaam Alaikum. I just wanted to comment about what that brother said in the middle. I think what you're talking about is apathy, and that is the biggest killer of people, not the weapons, it's apathy that kills people. Then secondly, I would say, I would have actually said the exact opposite of what you just said. I don't think the Shias suffer from any sort of inferiority complex. I think our problem is, so maybe there is a little bit of confidence issue, maybe just a little bit, but our problem is we actually see ourselves better than the Sunnis. That is why we keep ourselves to our own sentence. What is the reason that we refuse to go to pray Jum'ah? What is the reason that we refuse to pray Jama'ah with Sunni brothers and sisters? I know so many Shias who go home and repeat their prayers because they don't believe that the Sunnis do it right. We see ourselves as superior, and we don't think it's actually worth bothering about it to engage with the Sunni brothers and sisters. I would say that's our problem, and that is why we are allowing them to take center stage, because we're keeping to ourselves. We're saying, oh, as long as my prayers are fine, that's all that matters. We don't say, well, let me go to these Sunni centers and at least talk to someone about what I believe in, even if it involves not praying with a Torah.
Can do to respond to anti-Shia rhetoric. One of the brothers mentioned the search engine optimization idea. That's one very good idea. What other options do we have to respond to this problem?
Sunni to three types. The first type, they love and they support Ahlul Bayt, and that is one believer, mu'min. The second one, they love Ahlul Bayt, and that is a Muslim. The third type, they hate Ahlul Bayt, and that is a kafir. So in the Sunni sectors, the problem Sunni themselves they have them with a third one. The third one, they know one language is false. For example, in Iraq, if you go to a Sunni city or town, they come to the Sunni and they say, look, how many boys have you got in the family? Three. Give us one to fight the Shia and keep two. If you don't do that, we will kill all the three. The only language is force. They don't discuss. So now if we take two examples, take Syria. Syria, majority of Syrian Sunni are with the government. Only these little sectors, which they can't even fight the government, they import mercenaries, Moroccan, Algerian, and name it. Because they are not popular between the Sunni community in Syria. And you could see it on TV how they fight. You give them money, and they fight for you. If you take the example of Andalusia, in a matter of 20 years, the follower of Ahlul Bayt in Andalusia today is 30 million. And the 30 million, they come from the universities, mainly. So we have two. We have this type, and we have this type. I remember one time I was in East London, and I was watching the show from outside, and Iraqi Kurdish Sunni came out to find out what I am. I told him Shia. He went inside, and it was a Jewish show. He told him, tell him to go. It's not good for us. He said, sorry, go, we don't. Recently, Henry Kissinger, he said, we are planning a war between the Muslims themselves for another 100 years. So instead of a war between Israel and a Muslim, Muslim against Muslim. I have the experience in Regent Park Mosque. In Regent Park Mosque, it used to be about 20 Salafi. So I had a fight with them. I telephoned the police.
Physical fight?
Yeah.
A physical fight.
Physical. I telephoned the police. The police came and take all the 20 out of the mosque, and they told the manager of the mosque not to allow them in the mosque.
You're fighting 20 guys?
they are 20, but when you find only one or two will be left. All the rest they will make themselves, but has got nothing to do with it. So now you go to Regent Park Mosque. It's very normal mosque, very normal Muslim. So strategically, we have to plan how to finish them from every mosque. And plus, for a long range, we take the example of Andalusia.
With regard to rhetoric, right, I think all Shia Muslims should arm themselves with knowledge. And most importantly, actually, the knowledge of the Sunni madhab, their books, what they say. It's amazing though, when you read more about their books, you identify belief as a follower of Ahlul Bayt strengthens somehow, subhanAllah. Because all that thing that you've been believing in, it is evident in their books. So it is for you as well, self-development, strengthening your aqeedah as well. From that basis, because they won't believe in your books anyway, so you have to be knowledgeable in their books. And it is, and they are bound by their books. So if you present your case to them, in a friendly fashion, by the way, when it's important that if you get involved in these matters, you have to be patient, you have to be tolerant, you don't lose temper, you do not most certainly curse or swear at what people that they hold highly. Yes, that's the, you should not do that at all, because you'll be doing disservice to yourself and to the Shia as a whole. So it is important that you start your knowledge, and if you're not equipped enough, don't get involved, because you could be doing more harm than good. So it is important. Know their books, and then you can hold them accountable to what they believe. And you come across all kind of people. There's simple-minded people, really, they don't even know their madhab, themselves. You tell them there's a hadith, a so-and-so book, sahih hadith, say, what, where, how? So there are people like this, and also there are people adamant. They deliberate liars, slanderers. They just try to defame you for the sake of it. And we have a problems here. And this is that Allah, the Quran and the Sunnah is not enough. We are confronting people who think that the Sahaba are part of Aqeedah. This is the big problem. And we pay the price for this. When we say no, it is not the case, that's what's happening to Shia. Now, so this is the what I suggest that we should do is knowledge, and you also you have to have the ability and the characteristics to continue, so that at least you part with that person on friendly terms, or at least leave them to think about it overnight. That's the hope.
By virtue of the fact that you have read the translation, of course, the Bukhari and so on have been translated, so they might have a problem.
You see, the anti-Shia rhetoric comes out from groups which are the minority within our Sunni brothers. They're just a very noisy minority. That's why they, you know, their size seems magnified. I think one of the one of the most fruitful strategies of dealing with this issue might be by actually Shias going out of their way to empower the Sunni majority, who actually are not that bad at defending views such as Tawassul and you know, other things which these guys seem to just blame Shias for. And in Pakistan, it's the majority of Sunnis by far, like ridiculous, by a ridiculous ratio, they're not anti-Shia. In fact, they are very anti-Wahhabi. You know, the Wahhabis have assassinated their scholars as well. So I don't know what the ratio of Wahhabi to a normal Sunni would be in the West, but I think it would be quite successful by actually engaging those Sunni brothers who can defend us for ourselves. You know, we don't even need to do the work kind of thing.
On this fourth question, I think the best thing to do is to break the truth. A lot of social media
is the what?
Is to break out the actual truth in these countries. For example, in Syria, in Pakistan, in Bahrain, a lot of stuff are not actually seen. Not the whole image is seen. So what we've got living in the West is social media everywhere. Every single mobile phone, everyone is connected. YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, everything. We're interconnected. What we should do, if each person keeps tweeting and posting different stuff, just to outline the truth going on in these countries and to show how much Shias are being threatened and just pushed down and pushed to the side in the corner of their countries, we can show the world the real truth, what's actually going on. Because a lot of people, a lot of Shias in Pakistan, in Syria, in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia also, are just being pushed away. They're not even recognized by the government anymore. To a level that even the BBC, because they're Western-backed media, they back the West with everything. When it comes to the Arab world, they just close their eyes and just look aside. So what we should do, we should keep protesting and just show the truth behind all these lies being shown on their TV channels, especially in Syria right now. Because right now, what's happening in Syria is just going to a level uncontrollably showing that the government is killing everyone and that the Free Syrian Army are the true fighters. Well, in fact, a lot of soldiers are being killed. A lot of families have been separated and kidnapped for ransom. I know a story of a person, a family relative, her father was taken away by the so-called Free Syrian Army, and the ransom was 10 Sunnis to be released from prison. I'm like, automatically that shows this is just a war with Shia and Sunni. It's not actually a war between Shias and Sunnis. It's a war between the West and freedom in the Arab world. That's the problem. We should attack that and show everyone what's actually going on in these countries using the powers we've got, such as social media. Thank you.
So, brother, you tell me, if someone is determined to kill you and his faith is based on killing you and he believes that if he kills you, he'll go to heaven, you're going to tweet about it?
Mate, of course. We have to fight back. We have to fight back. But we're here.
Nah, and someone, if you're under threat to be killed, you just defend yourself.
In defense of the point
defend yourself.
Made.
That's it. Defend it.
They kill me.
In other countries, yeah.
Okay. No, I was thinking about your people living under...
No, most of these people don't have Facebook and Twitter because their governments have banned it, so...
I misunderstood that.
Yeah. You know, it just seems that there might be some minor stances that we can take from the UK, perhaps, because countries like Pakistan or Syria or anywhere else are very far distance countries. But I believe that, you know, we were told by examples that in the past and historically, Islamic historically, that, you know, to fight oppression, you fight with everything that you have. Yeah, the biggest, I think, example that we have to speak out the truth or against oppression is Maitham of Thamar, one of the most pious people ever to be, who spoke till his last breath, even until his tongue was removed. Having that in mind, when we did take part in the sit-in protest outside the High Commissioner of Pakistan, it did have a global effect. It was a domino effect. they felt quite empowered in Pakistan that somebody or some people in the UK were actually carrying out this act on their behalf or for them or against oppression. And I think that is the biggest voice that we can have in any country that we are. If we want to speak against oppression, we have to take action. When we find that people say, oh, but what action did it take just because you sat outside the High Commission? The answer is, next time we'll do it again, and we'll do it again, and we'll do it again. But endlessly, if we continue to raise our voices, raise awareness in whatever form we can take, it does have an impact. Oh, absolutely. I think what we have been trying and what we have been raising is awareness amongst all the population. It hasn't been just the Shia brothers and sisters. It's been through the Sunnis as well. And there's been a lot of people that I know personally who have from the Sunni community have come forward and said, whatever's happening in Pakistan is unjust, and somebody or something needs to happen, and we all need to raise voices. And I think it's even in Pakistan, we know for a fact that there were a lot of Sunni people, Sunni brothers and sisters that were actually out there with the Shia brothers and sisters to say, this is not just happening to you, it's happening to us, and we all stand as Muslims together.
Most of us has got a mobile phone with cameras. So, if we try to go to their meetings, these people are very stupid. So just ask them a question, and they will give you all what you want. And try to build a contact with the media, and send them these films. I give you an example. In Syria recently, they were filming Iraqi, Syrian, and Libyan. He told them, after you finish Bashar in Syria, what are you going to do? They said, we're going to come to the West, the big jihad, to finish the government in the West. So this is just one example, what can we do?
Yeah, I think this gathering that we've had is very important and teaches us a lot of things. Because we are talking about an issue that burns us in the Shia community. And out of that, we have heard lots of great ideas with respect to what we can do. One of the things, to put a synopsis on it, one is social prominence. That the more socially prominent you are, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, or a thief. The more socially prominent you are, your community is, the more you will be heard and the more you will be respected. If we as Shias are known to be true lovers of truth and justice, wherever we are, regardless of whether we are among Shias or we are among non-Shias, we will be identified with this. If we are known to be prominent in our universities and our jobs and so forth, in terms of pushing forward the issue of Muslim unity and what Shiaism actually means and justice in our community and so forth, we'll find many supporters and admirers among the rest of the community. The other one is we need to control and master our information. Right now, information is becoming decentralized. No longer could you have to rely upon TV time. You could make your own TV on the net. People were talking about this. We could find ways of putting our agenda higher up on Google when people, clicking on Shia. We need to be able to do things like this. We need to provide a self-defense program for our youth and our adults. An Islamic self-defense program that would incorporate both self-defense against the major arguments that they bring against us, train people in terms of like role-playing, where you have a person on a stage and you attack them with everything you have, ideologically now, and get them to defend themselves so they can stand up, and also teach them to defend themselves physically. And finally, and most importantly, we need to become more consolidated as a community. The more consolidated and the more unified we are as a community, the better impact we could make on this society, the better impact we could make at the polls, the better impact we could make upon the British government with respect to their relationships with places like Pakistan and so forth. And also, the more we are able to provide physical support, financial support, diplomatic support, moral support for those people on the other side of the world.
Sheikh Mohammed Hanif, thank you very much for that excellent conclusion and also for the presentation as a whole. Also, I'd like to thank everyone for their contributions today.